Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into the big story in the news, and that is the Iowa caucuses that are now taking place. We'll begin with David Sirota, a nationally syndicated weekly newspaper columnist, award-winning radio host, and best-selling author. He has an article at Salon that argues the intense media coverage has been incredibly expensive and disturbingly lazy. Then we will speak with a reporter on the ground in Iowa who has been covering the candidates and has spoken with prospective voters. Elise Foley, a reporter with the Huffington Post based in Washington, D.C., joins us. We will discuss how young voters are reacting to candidates trying to appeal to the youth vote and how Iowans who have been bombarded with negative TV ads are reacting to last-minute pitches by candidates who, at the end of the day, will be spending up to $250 per vote. Then finally, we will look into the significance of this relatively recent electoral phenomenon that is breaking campaign spending records and attracting unprecedented media coverage, yet has a mixed record in picking presidential winners. David Redlosk, a polling expert and professor of political science at Rutgers University, joins us. He is the author of Why Iowa? How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process. Joining us now is David Sirota, a journalist, nationally syndicated weekly newspaper columnist, award-winning radio host, and best-selling author. He is a regular contributor to Salon, and his weekly newspaper column appears in newspapers with a combined daily circulation of more than 1.8 million readers. His books include Hostile, The Uprising, and Back to Our Future, How the 1980s Explained the World We Live in Now. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Sirota.
Thanks for having me.
And David, when you say that the Iowa caucuses, the coverage has been incredibly expensive and disturbingly lazy, expand on that, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we're seeing is, look, we're living through a time where media resources are obviously finite, and they're being diverted out of reporting real news that matters to most Americans, state legislative news, municipal coverage, coverage of what's going on in the economy, war coverage. And so the same media industry that is pleading poverty and saying we need to make these cuts to that kind of coverage is also spending an inordinate amount of money covering what I think is basically a manufactured news event, an Iowa caucus where less than 150,000 people are going to vote. And they're spending a huge amount of that money in Iowa. And frankly, they're spending the money not even on reporting, on real reporting. They're spending it on what I think most people would acknowledge is punditry and stenography, that you haven't really seen much hard-hitting reporting out of the Iowa caucus. So you put it all together, and what you see is, frankly, I think a media that doesn't have its priorities straight, and and I hope that the next time that we hear media executives say, "Oh, we don't have enough money to cover the big issues of the day," everybody should remember what's gone on in the Iowa caucus and where those resources really went. They didn't disappear; they just went to a different place.
So does it strike you as paradoxical, though, David Sirota, that at a time when more and more Americans feel our politics are bankrupt, the media is celebrating it more than ever? On what you're talking about is, you didn't say it was meaningless, but it's only 150,000 people involved in this popularity context that has not really picked too many national winners since it's only been around for, 30 years at any rate.
Well, I think it is fascinating, and I think it's sad. I think it's fascinating that as cable TV has doubled down, for instance, on coverage of American politics, cable's ratings have basically gone down. As polls show that most Americans just want the campaign to be over, so much of the media is focused on the horse race aspect of campaign coverage. And I think what it says is that the habits of the media are so ingrained, the habits of simply covering the horse race, that the media, I think a lot of media institutions don't even know how to change, don't even know what to do differently at all. And let's remember that covering a manufactured news event like the Iowa caucus in the way that it's been covered, it may not be cheap, but it requires very little training and it requires very little expertise. So So in an era when you have less and less formal training in actual adversarial journalism, I think part of the reason we're seeing the focus, the double down kind of focus on the horse race aspect of politics, is because there just isn't the expertise to do real investigative journalism anymore. And that's a tragedy.
Well, David Sirota, again, journalist, nationally syndicated weekly newspaper columnist, award-winning radio host and best-selling author, regular contributor to Salon. We're talking about the press coverage of the Iowa caucuses, which is just beginning now. When you talk about the media wanting to cover process, which is what this is, a process story, and most of the reporting that comes out of Washington is a process story, isn't it also circumscribed by the media ritual of balance, where you have to have the pro side of the story, then the con side, and then you end up with a kind of meaningless mush? And there's an incapability on the part of the media to cover anything in realistic terms, for example, that doesn't have two sides. Like, for example, when the Tea Party threatened to shut down the government recently, they've done it a couple of times, as a matter of fact, that was not reported as one party sabotaging the whole works to get their way. That was treated as a process story. You know, the Republicans are doing this and the Democrats are doing that.
So, well, I think the reason that's happening, in my estimation, is because it's much harder, it takes more work to find fact, it takes far less work to simply say he said, she said. It doesn't really take a lot of expertise or a lot of elbow grease to simply say, all right, I'll get a quote from one side, I'll get a quote from the other side, and then I'll wipe my hands of it, and I won't actually find any fact. Actually finding fact, what's in a bill, whether what a candidate says is true, what do candidate proposals, what would they actually mean for the average person in America, that takes a lot more effort. And I think that we're living in an age where that effort, for many reasons, just isn't there.
But it doesn't take much effort to realize that it was the Tea Party and it led by Eric Cantor that was threatening to shut down the entire government over the tax ceiling and extension.
Well, I think then that gets to the other aspect. The other aspect is that it requires a willingness to challenge power. When you declare what is and is not fact, it may offend one or another side. It's a potential risk for the journalist, in the sense of you're becoming an adversarial journalist. You're saying this statement is not true, or this is the fact, whether the political powers that be like me stating that fact or not. To do he said she said journalism isn't really a risk of anything, and so there's definitely a risk aversion aspect to this.
Mm-hmm. So when you're covering, though, this is not a he said, she said in terms of a caucus that involves Democrats and Republicans. This is that there's no story on the Democratic side. This is a purely Republican horse race. What's your sense of whether there's any real context in the real quality or the lack of quality of these candidates? Because, frankly, some of them are ridiculous. A lot of what they say is embarrassing. None of them are particularly distinguished. And as they get more desperate, they appear even more absurd. But, you know, I'm allowed to say that kind of stuff because I'm I'm not in the mainstream media. You know?
Well, and I think, look, there are important distinctions between some of the candidates. I mean, I think there's very, very huge important distinctions between Ron Paul and all of the candidates in the Republican primary, and we haven't really seen those covered very well, because for a long time, I think the media didn't want to cover Ron Paul because a lot of the things that he was saying were, in a sense, an indictment of the bipartisan duopoly that the media has contributed to sustaining. That the media has for years, for instance, written out of the story any voices that oppose war. Ron Paul happens to be not only a voice who opposes war, but a voice who opposes war inside the Republican Party, which a red versus blue media has trouble processing. So the tragedy of it is, although I think that, Ron Paul, at least in the fact that he's surged in the polls, and we'll see how he does tonight, but the tragedy of it has been is that there are real differences that have simply been sanitized from the story. I mean, there's another candidate, Buddy Romer, is a former Louisiana governor, a congressperson. He hasn't even been allowed into the debates, and he's the guy who's, as a Republican candidate, saying we need to get money out of politics. And I would say that part of the reason he's been written out of the story is because, again, a red versus blue media doesn't know how to process any candidate, much less a Republican candidate, saying the kinds of things that he's saying.
Well, it is a bit strange, isn't it, though, David Sirota, when as much as the media tries to ignore Ron Paul and even in particular the right-wing media in the form of Fox News, yet nobody calls the rest of them to account for unbelievably reckless and belligerent statements. I mean, it's almost as if those Republican candidates can't wait to go to war against Iran. I mean, they made it real clear that they just want to bomb them right now, tomorrow. And Bachman is talking about using nukes. And I mean, isn't that wouldn't that in the real world be more of a story than Ron Paul's opposing war?
Well, you'd think it would be, but unfortunately, it fits into a meme, a storyline that the traditional political press has been more than happy to not question. I mean, you've had belligerent statements being made about Iran for years now, and it's become just part of the apparently part of the noise. That's not really much of a story anymore. Look, how we decide or how the media decides what is and is not blockbuster news, part of that has to do with repetition. I think that one of the evil genius moves of the Republicans and the conservative movement has been to simply realize that if you say something over and over and over again, that it will become normalized. It won't be treated as big or shocking news anymore.
So given, David Sirota, that we're at the beginning of this process, that's what's so extraordinary when you think about how much money's being spent in Iowa. It's apparently about $250 a vote. How do you see the rest of this year shaping up? Is it again a kind of paradox where the more bankrupt our politics become, the more money is being spent?
I think that as people become more and more disengaged, that the people running for high office are going to, frankly, have to spend more and more money. Until we, of course, change the campaign finance system. But part of the reason you see so much money going into these races is because you need to basically now harass people to even be interested in a process that most people are realizing is bankrupt. So, yes, I think there is a relationship between the citizenry realizing the bankruptcy of the process and the amount of money being spent in the process, that as the citizenry realizes the fraud that's happening, candidates feel like they have to spend ever more money to get the fewer and fewer engaged citizens to actually pay attention and care.
And in terms of the way that this Republican race has turned out so far, with a whole series of candidates being catapulted to the front runner status, and then being the balloon being pricked, and then one after another goes up and then down, it's almost like watching a merry-go-round. How much would you attribute that to the media's sort of hunger for a story? Did they sort of build them up and well, I suppose they tore themselves down eventually as reality intruded. But how would you assess that process? Is that something that's being manipulated, or is that just it's just that the embarrassing facts coming out?
I mean, I think it's a little bit of both. I think it's that. The public isn't happy with the candidates, and so there's a new flavor of the week, and people hope that the whatever flavor of the week is going to be the savior, and then they realize that the savior isn't perfect, and then there's a new flavor of the week. And I certainly think that the traditional media gets into the act of that. Oh, there's a new front runner, and that becomes the new story, and that's the new flavor of the week. I think it's self-reinforcing.
So out of all of this, is there anything that you, do you want to venture into any kind of punditry here in terms of what you think is going to happen and what's likely to emerge?
I don't want to predict, and I don't want to suggest what I think is going to happen. I can tell you what I very much hope that Ron Paul wins the Iowa caucus, and I hope that he wins the Republican nomination, that's not because I'm endorsing him or anything like that, but because I think he actually raises the issues that we most need to be having a discussion about in this country. Issues of American empire, civil liberties, ending wars, ending the drug war. These are issues that almost never get talked about in national politics, that we need to start having a national discussion about. And I think that if he wins tonight, and if he ultimately wins the nomination, which I realize is a long shot, but if he does, that conversation will be forced into the debate, whether the moneyed powers that be, whether the political establishment likes it or not.
Well, I suppose at the same time, some of what Ron Paul has said will also be forced into the debate. Like on Sunday, he blamed the Civil Rights Act for almost all the ills that have happened this country.
And I think it would be great to have a debate about that as well.
Well, David, I thank you for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with David Sirota, who is a journalist, a nationally syndicated weekly newspaper columnist, award-winning radio host, and best-selling author. He is a regular contributor to Salon, and his weekly newspaper column appears in newspapers with a combined daily circulation of more than 1.8 million readers. His books include Hostile, The Uprising, and Back to Our Future, How the 1980s Explain the World We Live in Now. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment speaking with a young reporter who has been covering the youth vote in Iowa. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Elise Foley, a reporter for The Huffington Post based in Washington, D.C. Previously, she worked for The Washington Independent, and currently she's in Iowa covering the caucuses. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elise Foley.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And obviously, it's a very busy day for you, and you've been covering some of the candidates as they reach out to the youth vote, I guess with mixed results. The 76-year-old Ron Paul trying to be hip referenced Kelly Clarkson, but there seems to be some real appeal for him amongst the young. Is that what you're picking up?
Yes, definitely. So this morning, there was an event at a high school. Michelle Bachmann, Mitt Romney, Rick Santorum, and Ron Paul all spoke. And I was chatting with a bunch of the high school students after, and not a single one liked any of the other candidates besides Ron Paul. I think that he really has this ability to appeal to young people that you don't see as much with some of the other Republican candidates. If you go to a Ron Paul event, you often see far more young people than you do at these other events.
And what was the objections that most of the young people had towards the others, and Bachmann and Santorum in particular?
Well, Santorum, as you know, is a very, very focused social conservative. He is very focused on things like gay marriage and abortion and promoting traditional marriage. For a lot of people, especially younger people who are more likely to support gay marriage, that's a really big issue. Him sort of what they see as bashing gay people when, you know, they know gay people, they have friends or relatives who are gay, that's a big problem for a lot of them. And that's something that a lot of people cited to me as a problem with Santorum.
So he's crashing into the millennials, right? Because they're, in many ways, I have a millennial daughter and her friends are all post-sexual and post-racial. And it's only baby boomers that are still hung up on this kind of stuff.
That's right. When you look at millennials in general, maybe they still have conservative values about economic policy and things like that. Many, many do. But in terms of social issues, a lot of them are just much more liberal than their parents and don't see it as the government's role to get involved in, you know, saying what's okay for someone to do, either with their body or who they marry, things like that.
So Elise Foley, again, reporter with the Huffington Post, based in Washington, D.C., previously worked for the Washington Independent, and she's currently in Iowa covering the caucuses. My understanding, Elise, is that essentially, even though they're not open primaries or open caucuses, pretty much anybody can vote. All you have to do is sign a piece of paper saying you want to vote as a Republican, and then you can rescind it later. So it's conceivable that a lot of young libertarians and young anti-war Democrats and even the Occupy movement people, could they not show up and vote for Ron Paul?
That's absolutely right. In fact, it's something that Paul's supporters will emphasize in the meetings. They'll often stand up at the end of his appearances and say, just remember, you could always go to the door and register as a Republican, whatever you've been before. So you do meet a lot of Ron Paul supporters who voted for Obama or, you know, supported Hillary Clinton last time around. So there's definitely the opportunity to do that. And, I mean, one thing that's a little funny, some people are participating because they have to. I spoke to some high school students today, and they said that they had to participate in the caucuses because it was for a grade. So I thought that that was kind of funny. Not everybody is there because they actually want to help pick the next presidential nominee.
So what's your sense then of yesterday it was a tie amongst Santorum, Paul, and Romney? Now we're told that Romney's lucky to break out. He's already announced himself the winner, but Gingrich did that earlier too, right?
That's right.
Give us your read on where it might be heading. I know we're getting down to the wire now.
Right. I haven't covered Romney as much as some of the other candidates, but just speaking to my colleagues, it sounds like the enthusiasm for Romney is really going up. I think that people like to get behind someone they think can win. Electability is very important to people. No matter who they support, people really want to get Barack Obama out of office. They really want someone, anyone, to win against him. And so I think as Romney seems to become more popular, that leads to more and more popularity, more enthusiasm for him. In terms of Santorum, you're seeing the same thing. You're seeing, and he mentions this in his speeches, you're seeing people who previously thought, I would support him, but I don't know if he can win. You're seeing those people fully going on board.
And this is a candidate who lost his Senate seat in Pennsylvania by a fairly sound margin. So it's a strange idea that he could suddenly be a viable presidential candidate.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because he often really talks up the fact that he is electable because he won in Pennsylvania in the previous, you know, his previous elections and re-elections. And so
he doesn't mention that he was recently defeated.
He doesn't mention that he lost in 2006. Right. So he'll say, you know, Pennsylvania has a lot of Democrats. The district I was in when I was in Congress had, a majority Democrats, and I still won and I still was re-elected. But you're right. He does not mention the 2006 loss.
But he got a big boost, didn't he, from one of the most prominent Christian conservatives in the state. And isn't that the theory, that in 2008, the Christian conservatives comprised 60% of the Republican caucus vote? And if they coalesce around a candidate and not split their vote between Santorum, Bachman, and Perry, he's likely to be a contender.
That's right. He did get that endorsement from Bob Vanderplaats of the Family Leader, I believe, and I think that matters to people. They respect Vanderplaats, and they want to see someone that, you know, if he thinks that Santorum is good, that means something to them. More and more, I think, like I mentioned before, since Santorum is growing his support, I think that some people who like Bachman, like Perry, are sort of saying, well, maybe we should support Santorum just for that reason of not wanting to split the vote. So I think that that's something that might have an effect tonight.
So, Elise Foley, it's extraordinary, though, how they've all gone up and then gone down one after the other. And we're barely mentioning Gingrich. A week ago, he was on the tip of everybody's tongue.
That's right. And just being on the ground here, you kind of see very few people mention Gingrich. Granted, I, you know, haven't been covering him as much as the other candidates, so I'm not meeting his very strong supporters, but for the most part, a lot of people I speak to, you know, at events for everyone are very skeptical of Gingrich. They are really repeating this line that is being put out by the Romney-supporting super PAC, Restore Our Future. They're putting out these ads saying that Gingrich has a lot of baggage. You hear Iowans just repeating that exact line back to you all the time. So I think that things like these attack ads are really catching on with Iowa voters.
So negative television ads work, and I guess he's got considerable money behind him, hasn't he, in the super PAC. Have you noticed how saturated the airwaves are, Elise?
Yes, absolutely. You cannot watch network TV without seeing constant ads, whether they be for or against a candidate. They're just playing all the time. So it's hard to escape it. And the other thing that's happening is the robocalls and the personal calls from campaigns are happening constantly. I was actually just speaking to someone who said that he cannot wait for this to be over because he's so sick of getting phone calls, and that his friend had said that he got 95 calls yesterday. Obviously an exaggeration, but people are, you know, getting these, hearing these, and some people are going to be swayed by them, even if just a little. If they have some doubts, they might, you know, be swayed by these robocalls and these ads.
Again, I'm speaking with Elise Foley, reporter for The Huffington Post, based in Washington, D.C. Previously, she worked for The Washington Independent, and she's currently in Iowa covering the caucuses. My understanding, Elise, is that a rough figure per vote now, in other words, how much money is being spent by these candidates to get a vote, although I guess in a caucus is not exactly a vote so much, but the long and the short of it is it's up to about $250 per vote. Is that what you understand?
I believe so. It's interesting to watch because the approaches are so different. Some people are spending so much more money than others. And so it's interesting to watch what that means. I think it'll say a lot about how Iowa caucuses will go in the future to see how, say, Rick Santorum, who's not spending that high amount of money, versus Mitt Romney or the others who are spending a lot of money. It'll be interesting to see what wins out, because it'll say, you know, what the right strategy is in Iowa going forward.
Mm-hmm. But we started out talking about Ron Paul, and he could be the surprise, right? Because you can't really quantify his support in as much as he's had what they call the best ground game. Is that what you understand?
Well, yes, he is extremely organized. He has a lot of people, you know, signed up to be caucus captains, which are the people who go to the caucuses and they speak on behalf of the candidate. And a lot of people go into these undecided, so they might, you know, be convinced by one of these people. So it's important that Paul has that. And yes, his ground game is good. He has a lot of support in local places. So it's true. He has a good shot at this.
Yeah. Well, what I was trying to figure out is what's going to be the surprise, given that this has been covered to death and polled to death and predicted to death and pundited to death, if that's a word. What's your sense of what hasn't been told so far or what could be a surprise?
Well, I think in terms of the final results, what could be a surprise, I mean, I sort of alluded to this before, but a lot of people were saying that Iowa, now that, you know, you do have things like ads, you have robocalls, isn't as much about going out, meeting people, doing all that work anymore. But you have candidates like Rick Santorum who really take it as a point of pride that they've visited everywhere in Iowa. So I think this will be a very strong test of that theory, and I think that could be surprising what the result turns out to be. The other thing that I think could be surprising is if Romney is able to clinch the win here, I think that says a lot about whether he'll get the eventual nomination, because the person who wins in Iowa doesn't necessarily get it. But that means that in Iowa, people were willing to look past some of their doubts about him, and people do have doubts. So I think that that could be a surprising and important fact or mm-hmm. thing to happen tonight.
So what is it, the general feeling, though? You talked about the young voters, and they were turned off by Santorum and Bachman's anti-gay stance and attracted to Ron Paul. But there's also been the presence of the Occupy movement there, in, I believe, mm-hmm. in the Renaissance Hotel in Des Moines. And the message from that movement has been a plague on both their houses, both Democrats and Republicans. And I think in the national, broader national picture, I don't think it's a reach to say that there's a lot of disgust with the Congress. Its approval is down to 9%. So I'm trying to get a sense here of this disconnect between what it seems to me a broad national kind of disgust with politics and politicians, mm-hmm. and in a sense that there's too much money and it's too corrupt on the one hand, and yet so much media attention is being paid to Iowa. So just as we're kind of turned off by politics and there's a sense of disgust, you know, the opposite's happening in terms of the media. It's almost they're celebrating democracy rather than being turned off by it.
I mean, I think you make a really interesting point. I think that that's not necessarily the full reason why there are so many media out here, but there is this fascination with this campaign, maybe more so than some others, although I think in 08, especially the Democrats had a very interesting race here as well. I think part of it is also that people really want to see someone that's a leader. They don't like, as you said, they don't like this partisan gridlock in Congress. They're sick of Congress that can't get anything done, that's, like you said, so tied up with money. So a lot of the Republicans have a message about that. So I think that that might be why this is seeming so important right now.
So, but when you say a lot of Republicans have the message about it, they've also been the object of a lot of the complaints about gridlock, particularly, you know, the Tea Party holding up the entire government over and threatening the full faith and credit of the United States, and more recently over the payroll tax cut increase. So there's a perception, I think, that the Republicans have actually been pretty obstructionist about creating gridlock. Yet there you're seeing in Iowa candidates campaigning successfully as being against big money in politics?
Yes, absolutely. You hear from a lot of the candidates that they want to, you know, end corruption and things like that. They don't want all this influence. At the same time, absolutely. I mean, the Tea Party has been very bent on obstructing these certain things. I think, though, the general sense that I get from a lot of Republicans is that they're obstructing the good things, or the things that should be obstructed, so they don't mind that. They just don't like when the Democrats block things that they want. They, you know, a lot of people, more so than I would have thought, are very frustrated with the Keystone Pipeline, which is sort of an obscure issue for so many people to care about, but a lot of them, you know, are very upset about the Democrats on that. So I think more the message that the Republican candidates have been making is elect me, but also get the Senate back to being Republican controlled, get a bigger majority in the House. And so that's sort of their solution for ending partisan gridlock, not exactly working better together.
So in other words, the Keystone Pipeline, which was attached to the payroll tax cut legislation, that actually worked as a wedge issue for Republican voters.
You hear people bring it up as an issue, which I mean, as I said, I find somewhat surprising, just given that it doesn't seem like something that would gain a lot of traction. But they mention it when they talk about energy. The candidates do, and the voters seem to really pick up on it. It's not the most important issue to people, but when they, you know, if you ask them about why they like someone's energy policy, that's something that they'll cite.
Wow. So they're basically saying that they've said it'll provide jobs and energy, and the Democrats are against jobs and energy.
That's exactly right.
Wow. Well, that's surprising. So I know things are about to come to a crunch now, and you have to leave us, Elise, but any inside tips on what you think is going to happen, or you just know as much as anybody else, right?
You know, as you mentioned before, there are a lot of pundits making a lot of predictions. I honestly don't know. I think it's between Romney, Paul, and Santorum, but that's about as far as I'm able to go. I think there's a lot of enthusiasm for all of them, and it'll be interesting to see how it turns out.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. Again, I've been speaking with Elise Foley, who's a reporter for the Huffington Post based in Washington, D.C., and she's currently in Iowa covering the caucuses. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with the author of the book, Why Iowa.
Some side with the leaves, some side with the seeds. But you and I will be undefeated by agreeing to disagree. No one wins but the thieves.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Redlawsk, who's a polling expert and professor of political science at Rutgers University. He's a co-author of the book, Why Iowa? How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process. And he has a recent piece in the New York Times about what Iowans want for their caucus candidates. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Redlawsk.
Thanks for having me.
And why Iowa? I mean, so far on the program, a couple of things have come up. One is that they're spending up to $250 per vote, and that there are only about 130,000, 150,000 people involved in this. And we're spending a record amount of money this year so far, it looks like. And the press is giving it record, you know, expensive coverage. So I guess the question, why Iowa, is even more intense now.
Yeah, it is, and it happens really every cycle. The basic reason for why Iowa is simply because it's first. And, you know, we like to play with the horse race. We want to see what's going on. This is the first time real voters cast real votes about the candidates. You know, it's been polling up until now. So, you know, we're naturally really interested in that, even if it is a fairly small number of voters overall.
But hasn't it basically, isn't this a relatively recent phenomenon that Iowa is the first state that it begins this whole primary cycle? I didn't think didn't this start basically, what, around the time of Jimmy Carter or perhaps before then?
Yeah, in fact, it started in 1972, so it's 40 years. Not sure if that makes it recent anymore or not, but nonetheless, it doesn't feel like that long ago to me.
Well, I'm talking about a 200-plus-year constitution.
Exactly, yeah.
And founding fathers and all that stuff, you know.
Following the 1968 Democratic Convention, there were changes in the rules, and those changes essentially created Iowa first by accident. But it was the Jimmy Carter campaign in 1976 that took advantage of it and first brought the media attention. We have a sequential system. The sequential system means somebody goes first, and whoever goes first would get this attention.
And why is it a caucus and not a primary? Why does it have this structure that the others don't have?
Well, it's a caucus, again, primarily for historical reasons. Iowa has actually used the caucus process, and so do another 13 or 14 states. Iowa's used it since before it was a state. It's the way the state has always organized its political parties from the ground up, from the precinct level up. And in some respects, that generates much stronger political parties because it's not a top-down process. It also means candidates have to run the kind of campaign that actually engages voters, that they have to really work hard to get voters out. And I think what that does is cause the candidates, frankly, to become better candidates and to show their ability to put together an organization.
So they do. They obviously have to do a lot of what they call face time. So maybe it's a good training for them. But a lot of complaints over the years I've noticed is that Iowa is a sort of white bread middle American state that doesn't represent a pluralistic America.
Well, to some degree, it's true. Although to be fair, first among the Republican Party, the demographic diversity in Iowa is not nearly as far out of line with the Republican Party as a whole. But secondly, Iowa's probably what we might call the middle state. On a whole range of factors, it sits pretty much squarely in the middle of the states. No one state's going to be representative. I mean, California is clearly not representative of the entire country, neither is Iowa. The sequential process works, I think, primarily because it puts together a string of states put together are reasonably representative of the range of voters in the parties. But no one state would be able to do that.
But that was no divine intention, was it? That's just how it worked out.
Oh, no. No, it's just happened that way. And, you know, what's the reality is you can't change it easily because, A, both New Hampshire and Iowa protect their position zealously and do it in law, and, B, any state that wants to jump first has the other 49 saying, why you?
Right, but that hasn't stopped them from trying.
No, it hasn't stopped them from trying, but it's stopped them from succeeding.
Right. Again, I'm speaking with David Redlawsk, who's a polling expert and professor of political science at Rutgers University. He's the co-author of the book, Why Iowa? How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process, and has a recent piece in the New York Times about what Iowans want from their caucus candidates. And as they are now voting, as we speak now, David, can you tell us what they want?
obviously one of the things they want is to beat President Obama. That's clearly true. But a lot of the question was, do Iowans care about the economy in the same way other people do? The unemployment rate's actually relatively low in Iowa. It's got a not entirely agricultural economy at all, but that plays a role. It turns out Iowans are pretty much as concerned about the economy as anybody else, and it's a clear driving factor when you get past the issue of beating the president. But the other really interesting thing that our research has shown over time is that Iowa voters are much more likely to vote sincerely, that is, for whom they really prefer, rather than taking into account things like electability. In a sense, the message Iowans send is a sincere message, here's who we like, as opposed to a message, here's who we think can win.
Well, that could be music to Rick Santorum's ears, right? And bad news for Mitt Romney.
It could be. There's no question. Romney is seen as the most electable by a long shot, and Santorum's way back on the issue of electability. But having said that, it's a real mix in terms of what's driving it, and for conservative voters in particular, they just really want to show what they believe.
So do you think, David Redlawsk, that Ron Paul could be a surprise? I just spoke with a reporter who'd been covering the youth vote and had been at high schools where Santorum, Bachman, Romney, and Ron Paul spoke. And then she's talked to the students who were listening, who were in the audience, and they all, she said, without exception, support Ron Paul because he's not a gay basher, you know. And these are millennial kids who in this kind of post-sexual, post-racial world where they're not hung up on all these things that baby boomers and Christian conservatives are so obsessed with.
Yeah, to the extent that Paul's tapping into that, it's definitely an advantage for him, except that at least historically, getting young people out to the caucus is pretty difficult. The Obama campaign managed to do it. They put a tremendous focus on it, really surprised all of us in terms of that turnout. And the Ron Paul campaign has certainly been doing that as well. They've been really organizing at the universities and colleges. So it may turn out that is part of his secret weapon. At the same time, I think if Ron Paul comes in first or second, you're going to see the sort of traditional Republican Party, the regular Republican Party leadership, tried to chalk that up as much to independents and Democrats, frankly, who crossed over. Because in Iowa, you can register for the Republican Party at the door tonight, and you can vote as long as you'll be 18 at the general election date, which is not normal in primaries. You have to be 18 at the primary date. So you can get those young people, and you can bring them from independency, where a lot of them are, or even among Democrats.
Well, indeed, David Redlawski, the reporter we had on before you from the Huffington Post, Elise Foley, said that at the Ron Paul caucuses or meetings, or whatever you call them, campaign appearances, they make no bones about encouraging libertarians, anti-war Democrats, Occupy people, you name it. They say, you know, you can sign up as a Republican just for the night.
Right, absolutely, and you can change back the next day. And some people do that. It's historically not a huge number, but it's certainly possible to be a larger number tonight, and particularly driven by the fact that the Democratic caucus going on at the same time is obviously not a competitive caucus.
Well, yeah, one wonders what's going on there. Would anybody show up? I mean,
well, actually, they're getting some turnout, and it's partly they've been doing a video feed with the president. Obama has been speaking to, you know, the caucus statewide and been taking live questions from specific caucus locations. So that's part of it. And there's also a real push for organization. That it's worth remembering, the caucuses are as much about organizing the parties as they are about the presidential campaign. In fact, maybe even more so. So they're going to elect local party officials tonight. They're going to start building their state platform tonight. And on the Democratic side, they're going to be working on the president's reelection campaign.
Again, I'm speaking with David Redlawski, a polling expert and professor of political science at Rutgers University. He's the co-author of the book, Why Iowa? How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process. And he has a recent piece in the New York Times about what Iowans want from their caucus candidates. David, what do you make of the meteoric rise and fall I've already forgotten his name.
How about
Gingrich?
Gingrich.
Yeah. The most recent one. I mean, we can go through the earlier ones.
Right.
But what do you make of that? Because literally a week ago, absolutely, everybody thought he was going to win. He said he was going to win. Now, I guess today, Romney said he's going to win. So.
Right. It's always dangerous to make those predictions anyway, and I was surprised that Romney made that prediction, because, you know, that's just dangerous. It sets an expectation level which frankly you don't want to set. In Gingrich's case, I none of us looking at this ever thought he was really running a presidential campaign. You know, he was out on a book tour. He wasn't building organization. His staff quit. You know, all of this. I think his rise reflected as much the media looking for somebody else to talk about after the rise and fall of Bachman and Perry and Kane. And he's interesting, certainly interesting to talk about. He's certainly interested in himself. And I think that, unfortunately for him, once Newt Gingrich continued to be Newt Gingrich under the glare of the public light, you know, the conservatives who thought that's where to go took a look and said, you know, this guy's really not got a real campaign. He's not going anywhere. So, you know, the media plays a big role in this. I mean, how the media talks about candidates really has an impact on how voters view them. The caucus itself actually is a huge factor of that. We've got certain expectations going in. I guarantee you, if somehow Rick Santorum actually wins this, that's going to be what everybody's talking about, and it will change the ground for Santorum dramatically.
And this is a candidate, by the way, who lost a Senate race by a very, very sound margin. That I find extraordinary, that he's already been repudiated by his own state. And yet, this guy makes Lazarus look good.
Well, it is interesting, and I think, you know, in some ways what it reflects with Santorum is that he's been doing the kind of traditional grassroots campaigning in Iowa that other candidates have not focused on as much. Bachman has, but she was long time yesterday's news. And in being on the ground, spending a lot of time face-to-face working the voters has potential to pay off. And I think once the media had run through everyone else, there's Rick Santorum. You start talking about him, the voters have heard from him personally, asked him questions, talked to him, and they're open to the possibility.
And even though he's basically been endorsed by the Christian conservatives, right? One of the big preachers there. You think he's not just reaching out for the 60% vote that in 2008 the evangelicals cast? I mean, is he trying to reach out to everybody?
No, I think Santorum is absolutely reaching out to evangelicals. That's where, you know, to put it in certain terms, he sees his market, and that's where it is. If you really think about the Republican Party at the moment, there are sort of three strands, and three candidates have you know, shaken out to fit those strands. There's the sort of traditional business Republican, and that's Mitt Romney. There is the libertarian Republican, and that's Ron Paul. And there's the evangelical conservative Republican, who are a big part of the Iowa caucuses. They're the ones who spent the entire year casting about looking for options. And they're the ones who now seem to have decided that among their choices, Santorum may be the truest blue, as it were, the truest Christian conservative.
Well, then, just as a political scientist, David Redlaws, let me ask you what strikes me as a paradox, that we are at a moment where registration for Democrats and Republicans, party identification is at an all-time low. I believe it's something like 30%, and now say they're Democrats, 20% say they're Republicans, and the vast majority say they're independents. There's a general disgust, if not distaste for politics, a sense of gridlock, and not a sense, it's a fact in Washington. So it seems that as our politics, our democracy appears to be more and more bankrupt, our media is celebrating it even more.
Well, you know, politics really is about conflict, and there's no avoiding that. It's always been about conflict. What differentiated it, perhaps to some degree, than compared to the present, is that you had leaders in Washington who, while they were certainly about conflict, also were willing to make deals when they needed to make deals. That is the real change, it seems to me, right now. That is that while politics has always been about conflict and there always have been sides, you don't have the ability to compromise in Washington. It is a funny business in a sense. There are two very different views of sort of the good life that run through American politics, and they're represented by, you know, generally by Democrats and generally by Republicans, and certain parts of those are not easily reconciled. So to make compromise in D.C. means you've really got to be able to push aside your own side briefly. With the rise, particularly in the Republicans, of the Tea Party, that's extraordinarily hard for Republican leaders to do because they're deathly afraid of primary campaigns against them. Witness what happened last time around in Delaware and Nevada. The Tea Party folks didn't really, you know, they were sure that being true conservatives was a winning thing. It's not a winning thing in the general election, but it certainly can be a winner in a primary. And so the Republican leadership, which is historically not as conservative as, you know, this Tea Party group, finds themselves boxed in.
Well, it just feels to me, since I'm calling you from Hollywood, where it used to be that we had, you know, the daily grosses or the weekend grosses weren't a big deal, and that people more and more talked about good films, not about films that made money. And now it's all about the films that made money and nothing about whether they're good or bad. And it feels the same way about our politics. You know, it's all about who's got the most money, who's spending the most, who gets the most coverage. It's all about process. It's not about context. It's not even about results.
Well, to be fair, it's been about process for quite a while. I mean, it's really hard for the media, this isn't an excuse, mind you, it's really hard for the media to get into policy details. It's far easier for the media to talk about process, and it's far easier for people like me to talk about process. It's just, that's reality. And you know, there's more media, there's 24/7, there are more outlets, you know, there's Twitter and Facebook and all the other social media things. We're so much better connected than ever before that I think it does feel like we're just inundated with stuff. And we're inundated at the same time that our politics, I agree, has become broken in many respects.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, David Redlawsk.
You're welcome, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with David Redlawsk, a polling expert and professor of political science at Rutgers University. He's the co-author of the book, Why Iowa? How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process. And he has a recent piece in the New York Times about what Iowans want from their caucus candidates. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we concentrated, in fact, we devoted the whole program to the Iowa caucuses. We were broadcasting live here in Los Angeles as the caucuses began. So at this point, we don't have the results, but that sort of leads you to the question of how come so much money and attention is being spent on about 150,000 people in a state that doesn't represent the broader demographics of the United States. What is really going on here? We started out with David Sirota, nationally syndicated weekly newspaper columnist. He has a piece in Salon that argues the intense media coverage has been incredibly expensive and disturbingly lazy. I tried to get him to expand further on why it is that the media is only interested in process and why they can't actually call it as it really is. Because you got, you know, so much disgust in the country with politics and the Occupy movement out there telling us how bankrupt our money-driven system is. And yet nobody but Ron Paul talks about it. And of course, he did make a strong pitch for Ron Paul, who he hopes gets the Republican nomination, not because he agrees with everything he said, but because he thinks that he will actually start talking about real things like war and peace. Now, obviously, on the Republican side, they're in a competition to see who could bomb Iran first. I spoke then with Elise Foley, a reporter with the Huffington Post in Iowa. She's covering the young vote. She'd been at a high school where most of the candidates had spoken. She told us that the young kids really are behind Ron Paul because he's not anti-gay and anti-gay marriage like the rest of them are. And that could be very interesting, given that the system is easy to game, in as much as any libertarian or anti-war young Democrat can show up and say, I'm a Republican for the night and vote for Ron Paul. So that will be something to watch. But in general, it's encouraging to think that in red states as well as blue states, that the millennials are definitely post-racial and post-sexual and are not interested in all of these cultural wedge issues that obsess the evangelicals and the Christian right, which of course has largely taken over the Republican Party. And then finally, we're looking into the significance of Iowa in general with the author of a book, Why Iowa? How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process. And of course, we learned that it all began only about 40 years ago. Jimmy Carter was the first person to use the Iowa caucuses. So it's not exactly new. And again, so few people participate, it's hard to believe it has become so significant, particularly to the media. But as I say, we already discussed the idea that the media is more interested in process than outcomes. And that seems to be the case here. But he basically defended the electoral system as it is and, you know, basically saying that politics will only get better when the American people demand it. Not that he said that, but that's my editorial interpretation of what he said. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graeme Fitzgibbons. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with a man she loved.